Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the Blog Talk Radio studios in the heart of Hudson County. You know it, folks. It's always in Union City. Insider NJ proudly brings to you Politically Direct. And I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 7th of February. Yes, folks, the year 2019. And I hope you're all having a wonderful start to Black History Month. I know I've been talking about it extensively with my students in my courses. And certainly I hope you are all doing your part, again, to honor the excellent contributions of the African-American community, not just throughout the month of February, but throughout the entire year. And we're proud to do so here on Politically Direct and also via Insider NJ. And of course, I want to thank you all for listening from wherever and however you may be doing so throughout the Garden State and, of course, throughout the good old U.S. of A. Now, you can always write to the show's inbox, ladies and gentlemen, which is Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. Once again, if you have any thoughts on future guests or topics, love to hear from you. Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. If you have, again, any suggestions for guests coming up for the month of March, we have some great guests already booked here in February, so we're taking any suggestions that you may have for guests throughout the month of March and April as well. So again, write to me, Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. Now, don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at Politically Direct NJ. You can also follow me directly on Instagram at @your_favorite_Fernando. Check me out on Twitter at Professor F. Uribe. And as well, ladies and gentlemen, if you are a Facebook subscriber, do me a favor. Just take a moment, click the like button, and tell everyone to do so on Facebook for Politically Direct. I do appreciate all the love on Facebook, of course, on Twitter, as well as Instagram. Brand new followers, brand new shares, brand new likes each and every day. So I must be doing something right, because you're all showing me love on all of the program's social media platforms. So again, I'm deeply grateful and humbled to all of you for supporting Politically Direct. Now, don't be shy, ladies and gentlemen. Call me toll-free this evening, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the absolute best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey, and what I will argue is the absolute best journalism that you'll read each and every day on your smartphone, PC, Mac, or tablet. So again, check it out, www.insidernj.com. Once you go on the homepage, you'll see the subscribe button at the very top, and once you do that, you'll be enrolled absolutely free of charge in our morning intelligence briefing, conveniently delivered to your inbox, folks. So when you're waking up in the morning, having that fresh pot of coffee, maybe checking out the sports talk shows on ESPN or Fox Sports, or maybe check out the cable news and what's going on with the headlines, and maybe you're looking just at your phone or your tablet, it'll be right there for you. The morning intelligence briefing, courtesy of Insider NJ. Again, once again, www.insidernj.com. Folks, don't forget to get all of your news every single day from Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week here on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or the staff. Folks, again, we have a great guest coming up in just a few moments, so stay right where you are. Again, 818-572-8032. Again, our toll-free number brought to you by Insider NJ. And folks, I'd like to get started today with a topic that's really been on my mind, and I've talked about this extensively before on this program. I was fortunate enough to appear on NJTV a few weeks ago on Reporters Roundtable with the great Michael Aaron talking about this issue. And it's something that really, I think, sheds light on sort of the hypocrisy, I think, that's existing in a lot of our political climate. And I talked about it again during my appearance, and I'm going to have to bring it up again. But as far as I'm concerned, there's a level of hypocrisy that's not going away here when it comes to the way we deal with victims of sexual assault. And I think just the way we go about investigating things in New Jersey, I think it's casting a very dark cloud over my home state, and I know a lot of us don't like it. And that is the subject of my first shot here tonight on Politically Direct. Now, folks, again, if you've been following the story, even today it was broke today on New Jersey 101.5 FM. Senior political director Eric Scott reported that a new 75-page report on how an accused rapist managed to get hired into a senior position within Governor Murphy's administration. And unfortunately, the governor has done very little to sort of squash the scandal. Now, the governor went on to say, quote, that the report compiled by former state Supreme Court Justice Peter Venero revealed hard truths. What it did not do was provide many answers and any hope that Murphy had this report would make the scandal go away. And unfortunately, that has not been the case for the governor's office. Now, State Senator Loretta Weinberg, a Democrat out of Bergen County, dismissed the Venero report, saying it fell short of the comprehensive report the governor promised. Quote, she went on to say, there continues to be too many unanswered questions, too many inconsistencies and contradictions, and too many people unable to provide a true accounting. Weinberg said in a statement released after the report was made public yesterday. Now, Weinberg and other members of the legislative committee looking into the hiring of Al Alvarez and his prior alleged rape of fellow former campaign staffer Katie Brennan have become increasingly frustrated by the lack of answers from current and former members of the administration and campaign staff. They have consistently failed to even describe how the hiring process worked during the transition. Now, again, according to the reports, the Venero report offered little clarity. It does not answer one of the most basic questions. Who hired Al Alvarez? Now, that question has perplexed the legislative committee from the very start, and frustrations among the committee members seemed to boil over on Tuesday. There are some in the committee that believe that the Venero report was nothing more than the governor trying to cover his own behind. Now, the report goes to great lengths to say that Murphy did not know about the allegations against Alvarez when he was hired. Multiple current and former Murphy staffers and campaign workers have insisted the governor was unaware. Committee members simply are not buying that. After the alleged assault, Brennan emailed the governor directly to ask for help, and he responded almost immediately, quote, we know you well, we're on it. When trying to figure out who hired Alvarez, State Senator Sandra Cunningham, a Democrat right here out of Hudson County, suggested the order came from the governor himself, and the head of hiring for the transition didn't deny it was possible. Now, committee members had intended to finish their investigation before budget negotiations begin in a few weeks, but are now not sure if that's possible. A lack of answers from administration officials are not just frustrating lawmakers, but also making them angry and more determined to figure out how this happened and how to prevent it from ever happening again. Now, the governor is already facing a lawsuit from Katie Brennan, and if the legislative probe continues, it will certainly impede his ability to advance the progressive agenda that the governor ran on, and certainly will undermine his credibility with New Jersey residents that are already skeptical of how costly this agenda is going to end up being. Well, folks, again, and listen, Insider NJ also has provided a good chronology of what's been going on here. But in case you're not familiar with the story, let me give you a succinct, you know, a synopsis as I can here, because there are a lot of details here, and I could spend 2 hours talking about it. But the most concise way I can describe the scenario is the following. In the summer of 2017, it's my understanding, and again, this is going by reading the transcripts from the committee hearings, that Katie Brennan, along with Al Alvarez and other campaign staffers, were socializing after a long day of campaigning, I believe, in Jersey City. Apparently, it's my understanding that at the end of the evening, Al Alvarez and Ms. Brennan shared, I believe, a ride-sharing service. I'm not sure if it was an Uber or Lyft, but regardless, it's my understanding, according to testimonials, that Mr. Alvarez was able to gain entry into Ms. Brennan's home and subsequently proceeded to sexually assault her. Ms. Brennan was able to escape at some point and lock herself in her bathroom, and which subsequently, I'm not exactly sure what the time frame was, but she did notify her husband, who was out of the country away on business for his job, and also I believe she contacted a close personal friend. I don't know exactly the time frame after the assault, the alleged assault, but I know it was relatively within a quick amount of time. It's my understanding, as we're moving on the chronology, that she approached the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office with these allegations after, I believe, a thorough vetting, according to what Hudson County Prosecutor Esther Suarez made public. There was not sufficient evidence to charge Mr. Alvarez with a crime, and subsequently the investigation ceased. I believe during that process, I believe that Ms. Brennan informed the governor's office of what had happened. And again, according to testimonials, the governor indicated that he was going to get on it, as I just mentioned right now in the article. And subsequently, as we're all aware, last October, the Wall Street Journal published a very in-depth story concerning Katie's testimonials, and thus this is what prompted the committee hearings in Trenton in front of the legislature. Subsequently, I believe even last month, the Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office, who also took up the case, decided not to file charges either because there was not sufficient amount of evidence to pursue an indictment or an arrest. And leading up to that, obviously, Ms. Brennan was not very pleased with the, with the, I guess, the progress of the case. It's my understanding her attorneys have decided to sue the state of New Jersey. I believe one of the defendants named in the lawsuit is indeed Governor Murphy. I'm not sure if Attorney General Grewal is also mentioned in there, but I believe that the governor's name is on there. And again, we have seen that the Attorney General's office has published sort of a new mandate when it comes to the reporting of sexual assaults in New Jersey. As we can see that the other day, we saw the testimony Tuesday of what this report was consisted of with former Judge Pete Venero. And that's where we stand today, folks. And to me, let's be very honest, part of the problem I have with this entire process is I just don't see the same amount of outrage that we should. And I think it sends a bad message to victims of sexual assault in New Jersey, both men and women. Because, folks, let's be honest, and we have a very – some of us have a very selective memory. But if you all recall last autumn when then – Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who was nominated by the president to succeed a new vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, apparent allegations from 30-plus years ago were levied against him by Professor Christine Blasey Ford. And we all know the hysteria that, you know, ensued on social media. We saw hashtag believe her, hashtag believe women. And we started seeing, and this is a point I made on NJTV very openly, I was sort of surprised that, you know, many prominent Democrats, both statewide here in New Jersey, starting with our junior senator, Cory Booker, to other Democrats, to the governor, to even national Democrats, were up in arms and outraged about the fact that Professor Ford was not believed, that her allegations were not taken seriously, and they felt that there should be a thorough vetting and that we should believe women. And there was an outrage all over social media. I remember just seeing people just getting into arguments for reasons, again, still unbeknown to me, but we saw sort of what this contributed to the political climate. And now, folks, a few months later, you can hear a pin drop with the silence here in the Garden State. Like, where's the justice for Katie Brennan? Where's the outrage by prominent Democrats and liberals in New Jersey that were so up in arms and outraged about Brett Kavanaugh, right? About allegations that were 30 plus years old. And I think we've learned that a lot of these allegations have been debunked. And we've learned that a lot of these allegations were proven to be not true, but we saw Brett Kavanaugh's character and reputation dragged through the mud by United States senators during those ridiculous confirmation hearings, whether it was Senator Kamala Harris out of California. We saw Cory Booker up with his selective moral outrage. We saw other senators. And, you know, thank goodness for the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, for sticking up for Brett. Because I felt he was being lowballed also with this. And, of course, you know, the mantra was believe Ford, believe women, believe her, believe all women, right? That's all the hashtags you saw. But here in New Jersey, you don't see believe Katie. You don't see anything about hashtag justice for Katie. You don't see anyone demonstrating. We saw thousands of people demonstrating outside the United States Supreme Court last fall, denouncing the selection of Brett Kavanaugh as a potential justice for the Supreme Court. Fortunately and thankfully, he was confirmed by the Senate, and certainly he's serving now in the Supreme Court, so congratulations to him. But folks, do you not see the hypocrisy here? Do you not see the inconsistency in New Jersey where, hey, last fall, we have to believe Professor Ford and all women, right, when it comes to victims of sexual assault, but we're not believing Katie Brennan? Folks, do you not find the irony in this? You can't find Cory Booker on this issue. You can't find Governor Murphy on this issue. You can't find other prominent Democrats. But you found them last fall, but you don't find them now. And as far as I'm concerned, if that's not hypocrisy, then do me a favor. Define it for me. Because as far as I'm concerned, this is the crystal clear definition. And I feel bad for Katie Brennan. I don't know her personally. I've met her many occasions. I think highly of her. I applaud her courage for what's going on. But this is the problem. She's not getting a fair shake here in New Jersey. And based on what I'm seeing, I don't know if she ever will. And that's a tragedy. It sends a really bad message to victims of sexual assault, both men and women, here in the Garden State. And that's my first shot here on Politically Direct. Folks, 8:15 here on the East Coast here, Eastern Standard Time. Again, I hope you can call in here. We have great guests coming up in just a few seconds here. So, again, as I mentioned, call in later tonight. I'd love to hear from you, 818-572-8032. Toll-free number brought to you by Insider NJ. And now at 8:15 on the East Coast, it's my pleasure to welcome to Politically Direct once again. He was an outstanding guest last year. I'm very excited to have him on again this year. Mr. Hugh O'Byrne, the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association. Mr. O'Byrne, how are you?
Hi. I'm well, Fernando. How are you? It's so good to speak to you a year on.
Yes, it definitely is. And you know what, Hugh? Part of me is ecstatic to have you on because there's a lot to talk about. But part of me is also disappointed, not because of you, Hugh, but part of me is disappointed because it seems like, we're nowhere closer than we were a year ago when we talked about this very issue. And this was one of those topics that during the summer of 2017 and going into the fall, that then candidate Phil Murphy campaigned on rigorously. He campaigned rigorously on a minimum wage, which took almost a little over a calendar year to get through. And now it seems that, the next process is to sort of find out what we're doing with decriminalizing marijuana and the outright legalization. And I'll tell you something, Hugh, I'm as much an optimist as anybody, but I sometimes don't trust the legislature to work, man. I mean, they have been lethargic on this. And I don't get the sense that there isn't a sense of urgency, I think, in Trenton right now about this issue. Am I wrong about it?
Yeah, I actually think so. I'm asked this question a lot, and I my response is that I'm combatively optimistic in that I see so much of the work that's going on in this, and then also from a perspectival concern, I look at this as saying, okay, yes. There were some statements that were made at different times in various political processes about how we would just kind of get this done at a time frame that is, clearly way past due. I don't think meanly about that, because as I look at what's going on, I see a number of things. One, and this is most important, the actual facts of the situation are that we had one of the most constrained medical programs there was in the nation. And the proposition was that we were going to go from that right to legalization. That's a step that no state has done. And we were going to do it even if it was within 24 months. And we're still going to be really amazed. It's an incredibly difficult process, and while it's very obvious that we have all of the political issues that are typical of any state, and we in New Jersey in particular has its own political issues that are going on, and that's obviously a complicating factor. I see that on this issue, it does transcend some of those types of traditional political concerns, and that everyone that's involved in it really does want this to be as good as possible and to be done as appropriate as possible. And it's very much a massive undertaking. I've seen a huge amount of work from our legislature on this. Difficult work, because it's difficult in the sense that between moving a bill and going through the various amendments and listening and crafting and debating, there's also the coming to terms with the proposition itself, which is something that it requires a great deal of fortitude, a great deal of prudence, a great deal of consideration. So all of those things have been happening. And I feel that we are in a good place, and I think we'll see something much sooner than later that will be quite positive along these lines. And as I've looked at the bill and the morphing of the bill, both for the expansion of the medical program as well as the adult use bill over the last however many months, 9 months or so that it's been really an active item, it's morphed a great deal. And it is a fascinating piece of legislation, and as someone who pays attention to these types of legislation around the country, it has really ingested a lot of the concerns that many states have recounted, saying, I wish I had done this, I wish I had done that. It shows a great deal of concern, I believe, and I think it's actually incontrovertible. A great deal of concern for social justice and social equity concerns, which are paramount, things we hear a lot about. An area that I also want to note, and I just don't hear as much about this, and maybe it's because of the complexities of the bill. The bill itself actually shows a great deal of concern for entrepreneurial activity and small business opportunity. And so from an industry perspective, I find that fascinating and also very complex and challenging and overall a wonderful thing to see the amount of concerns for so many different aspects of introducing an entirely new industry into a state and an industry that has some contention around it, for sure. I think that there's been a great sobriety in the way that our legislature and that our governor has pursued some really difficult things. And I feel like we are close. And, you know, I might look a fool in 2 months if nothing's happened, or I might look, you know, prescient that we're really getting there. And what we will end up with will be something very comprehensive, and it will have a great deal to be excited about, and it'll come no doubt with a great deal of frustrations as these intentions find their rootedness in the actuality of the economic realities around cannabis and around the state. But like with any legislation, I think our best hope is that the legislation will position us directionally for the next most efficient, effective, and just step. I don't think anyone should ever think that we're going to be done and complete, especially when we're inaugurating something. Re-inaugurating has been over 100 years since we've had legal cannabis in New Jersey. So it's going to be a very interesting time, and there'll be more to come, of course, as we actually start to encounter the results of all of this policy thinking and deal with the frustrations that no doubt will come and deal with those problems. But I really applaud everyone for having put the mandate before us that we're going to have the problems to deal with and not hide from them. And I'm quite thrilled with what I've seen. Actually, you know, and I know this is going to sound stupid or hopelessly sycophantic, but I'm really, and I'm someone who is generally apolitical, or at least cynical about politics completely. I'm actually proud of our legislators and our governor on this issue, our legislator, our governors, so many of the people that are trying, pro and con, by the way, but really actually mm-hmm. spending a lot of time thinking about the actual substantive matters at hand. And that from a process point of view and from a civics point of view, there's a lot there for us to be proud of. And that's not something that people really, we tend not to for many reasons, note these really positive moments that our public servants have brought to us and that have been really tough, and where they're the ones who will have to live with the day after casting the S vote and as this unfolds. So there's a lot of bravery, there's a lot of sobriety, there's a lot of care, and there was a lot of, frankly, putting interests of the whole ahead of the interests of many individuals, as far as I could tell. It's not perfect by any means, but I see a lot of this legislation. I'm pretty impressed. And the fact that we are where we are, yes, maybe time frames were too aggressive that were stated earlier last year, but in a realistic way of looking at this thing and comparatively to other states, we're actually sort of ahead of schedule, I'd say. Well, think about it. We just had these six operators that were hectored and pilloried for so long by the more prohibitionistically inclined government, you know, administration before it, right? And then from that, we're going to go to a comprehensive, highly regulated, but comprehensive industry, and we're really, everyone else has been 2, 3, 5. California went legalization last year. They began their experiment with legal access to cannabis in 1998. We're doing it in a greatly accelerated time period. So I'd have to say I do disagree with I'm totally understanding of the frustrations, and I live them on a daily basis, of course. Well, I'm totally understanding of that. I think that there's this sort of, there's an easy to overlook set of really quiet struggles for the good that have taken place in our government, in this state, which is not something that people often recognize. And on this one, I'd like to point that out. That's my opinion of having been so close to this for so long. And by the way, I mean, massively frustrated. Don't get me wrong. Massively frustrated at many, many points in time. But I look at it and say, well, you know, this is a very serious matter and it's a very big matter. So we're going to just have to, man up and take the next best step. But I do think we're actually quite close. I think we are there, even with the political climate as it is. So, we'll see in the next couple of months if I'm right.
No, listen, Hugh, and again, I appreciate how, specific you've been right now in your narrative, because I think it's important for our audience to understand what this means. And folks, if you're just joining us right now, it's 8:30 here on the East Coast, and here on the program, it's great to have once again the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association, Mr. Hugh O'Byrne. You can check out their organization online at www.newjerseycia.org, and you'll find a wealth of information there and resources that this organization provides for us in terms of educating the public when it comes to cannabis and certainly everything going on right now. Hugh, a lot to dissect there, and being the educator that I am and the academic, I like to dissect things and analyze them as best as possible. And there are a couple of things that stood out for me right now in your narrative that really I think are at the heart of the matter. And one of the big components I feel that many New Jerseyans are looking at this and perhaps are frustrated is because of the social justice or the criminal justice reform dynamics that I think are still lagging. I know last summer here in Hudson County, and the reason why it's so relevant, on my local podcast, I was able to have the chief prosecutor in Jersey City, Jake Hutnut, on, and I know that both the mayor of Jersey City, Stephen Fulop, and the chief prosecutor sort of took it upon themselves to look at decriminalizing marijuana altogether, and certainly that got the attention of New Jersey Attorney General Grewal. There was a little bit of conflict in the headlines as to how to proceed. We know that the Attorney General's office said, let's put a moratorium on any prosecutions at the municipal level after Labor Day. Well, Labor Day came and went. There was some instruction by the Attorney General's office to how to proceed as it pertained to municipal courts. We know there's been a little bit of a backlog, I think, in municipal courts all across the state. But I think that, you know, even before we talk about the outright legalization, and I've talked about this on my podcast before, Hugh, I mean, before getting into academia and higher education, I mean, I saw this firsthand by working in our criminal justice system. You know, I worked at different county jails, both in Hudson and in Essex County, respectively, and I worked with people. I worked with people that, you know, people of color specifically, who are incarcerated, who consume the majority of incarcerated persons in New Jersey. And I was always demoralized because I felt that, you know, we're incarcerating people for marijuana when the science is out there, the research is conclusive that it is nowhere near, if at all, harmful the way we look at other narcotics. And specifically, right, you know, the fact that violent crime is directly correlated with harder drugs such as cocaine, such as opioids, such as heroin, such as crack. And there's no correlation in any of the science that tells us that marijuana is associated with criminality. And we keep locking men, women, and juveniles of color, you know, black and brown, at really high rates. And, and I've always looked at it as it's such a waste of resources, both law enforcement, both in our judiciary, both in our PTI departments per county that deal with this. And I just felt, and I've had state senators on this show since the inception, and I've always been adamant about, you know, talking about this and saying this is where the legislature really has to kind of put the foot on the pedal. I'm not saying rush it through, but I still think that, to your point about we're getting there and it's moving along, certainly, you know, we're a little bit closer than we were last year. But what's really demoralizing to me, though, Hugh, is the fact that the aspect of decriminalization is so vital for criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
Because, again, as long as we keep locking up people, regardless, you know, of color or their white counterparts, who, by the way, the data will tell you that white people smoke marijuana at comparably the same rates as their black and brown counterparts, but they're not locked up anywhere near black and brown people, which is demoralizing in itself. But that's a topic for another day.
Yeah.
But the problem is, I think that the legislature doesn't seem, at least from my understanding, there doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency. You know, we know how Trenton can be very lethargic. It can be a laborious process in terms of getting them to act on legislation. I mean, listen, right now, what's bogging down Trenton? We have budget talks that are going to start soon, right? It's February. The legislature has to start talking about the budget because it's constitutionally mandated by the state to pass the budget by June 30th. But also, you know, again, I don't know if you had any chance to hear my opening monologue, but certainly the allegations that seem to be dogging the Murphy administration concerning the Kitty Brennan case and the way that they're looking at hirings and, you know, the way sexual assault is being perceived in New Jersey. I mean, these are all bogging down hearings and committees in Trenton. And not to say that they're not important. They're very important. But the idea that decriminalization seems to have been like, hey, the minute the governor took office, this should have been right at the top of the list. I understand the minimum wage was a very big issue, and I know that the governor had to sort of appease his progressive base that voted him in. But I just feel that it's so lethargic of a pace when it comes to decriminalization. And it's something that, honestly, Hugh, we're seeing the benefits of it as it's functioning in other states. And I just don't know why there isn't more of an outcry.
Well, you know, you actually raised a very good point. And it's an amazingly important point because as we talk about, from as I look at things, my general perspective is going to be focused most on sort of all of the nuances of industry and how the economics are going to work, et cetera, and how legalization has always been sort of a de facto decriminalization. But you raise a great point. It's a point that you one has to really wrestle with, and that is how can we be okay with waiting even 1 minute if we know that we're dealing with an injustice at the root of depriving people of their liberty and property over something that makes no sense. So how what retort is there to that? And really, frankly, at some sort of supreme level, there isn't, right? If it is the case that we agree that and that others agree that this is a matter where we see an abuse, and particularly this horrendous aspect of a skewed abuse toward race, which of course has always imbued everything about this prohibition of cannabis. And we've seen that. We've seen that people are being deprived of their fundamental freedom for exercising their adulthood in other areas. But many, many people, they possess cannabis because they want to, and they're quite mostly adults. And we're willing to deprive them of the liberty and their property for having exercised their adulthood in that manner. And we come around, come wake up and say, oh, my goodness, that's appalling. Once you have that realization, how is it? And I think this is where you're getting at. How could it be that we as a civil society would say that, well, even one more day of that continuing is tolerable? And I don't think there really is an answer to that that would satisfy, except for the fact that the natural mechanisms of civics grind on like they do to try and create the best, most comprehensive situation possible. And why did they not do a decriminalization first and immediately before legalization? Well, a decriminalization without legalization, I find to be thin sauce. Because it tends to stimulate a lot of black market activity. And of course, it only decriminalizes very, very small, negligible ones. There's a certain schizophrenia to the whole thing. So you just say, well, no, if we're going to make that step, if we're going to decriminalize it, well, let's call it what it really is and legalize it and regulate it for all of the reasons that we're thinking that we would. And we've gone down that path. It didn't go as quickly as we would have liked to on those points. And what we need to just say is, well, we are at the best moment right now for getting that done. And I think there is, I mean, what I see is a lot of hard work. I know that there are these other issues that are out there, but I haven't seen anyone slowing down on this. I see some of the work that's going on and some of the time it's taking is getting a broader-based understanding and internalization of the situation that you elucidated, right, this problem, getting it really sunk into people and then coming up with the types of strategies for redress. We have decriminalization, yes, but then we have to expunge. We have to deal with those who are already criminalized for their past uses and as a result have been sanctioned away from being vital members of our society in so many capacities. And then from there, the corollary to that is, well, we're now going to, once we have something legalized, we're going to have an economy around it. It's an economy we're going to value. It's an economy we're going to do things like tax and take advantage of as a society and build wealth and the public purse. So we need to actually now think, well, okay, the next phase of that is the social equity. So some sort of restorative justice for the ills of the past. You start layering these things in together while also dealing with just the realities of where we are and the administrative complexities of undoing so much infrastructure. I mean, really, when cannabis was made illegal, there were no televisions, right? Just think about that and then think now we're going to undo so much of that, and so much of civic life has gone through prohibition, and so much of the infrastructure of civic life has been accreted over that. Now we want to go back, and we want to do expungements, and we want to do redresses. There's a certain amount of just having the realities of trying to deal with the administrative burden of aligning all of these stars. Would everyone want to see the justice elements of this done immediately? Yes, but the complexities and the realities have been such that a truly comprehensive solution to a complex phenomena of injustice resides really in the full legalization that we're at. Now, would that it was done earlier? Yes, but I feel it's imminent, and I feel that on the social justice and the social equity side, there's a great deal to be very, very hopeful and proud of. So I know that's a little bit of a hedge statement. I want in my heart, like all others, when you see this injustice for it, my God, this must end, right? Why, how can we tolerate another day of it? Shame on us. And then on the other hand, that, well, the actual doing of it and the actual practicalities of moving this mechanism just require a great deal of thought, and then just moves through our, you know, just everything in politics just takes a long time. And so that's it. It's not a great answer. And the reason why it's not a great answer, Fernando, is that there really isn't a great answer for that. Once you elucidate that, once you state that problem, that's true. There's no great answer for it, other than now it must be done. And this right now, where we are with this bill, is the closest we are in any avenue from a legislative point of view. So now we have it. Let's just take it across this last step, and then begin the process of really implementing it. That's what I would say.
No, definitely. And listen, and this is the thing, though, Hugh, I think that a lot of our audience maybe isn't aware of is, you know, a lot of these social issues that are also of an economic nature get people energized. They certainly get an electorate very motivated. They get people certainly intrigued about how feasible this is going to be in New Jersey. We've seen what it's done in other states. And, you know, something you just mentioned that was really interesting to me, because I know you're not very political, and that's great, and I applaud that. You know, here on the show here, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, that's sort of like the goal of the show for me. But one of the things that concerned me about this entire narrative, though, Hugh, is as we've seen it materialize in other states, we've seen it become law in Colorado and other states out west, and even in the Midwest, and even to some extent in the Northeast, you know. But the bottom line, though, Hugh, is a lot of the rhetoric, I think, that's alarming is it seems that, again, and I don't want to speak for the governor, because I'm hoping to have the governor on in March, as hopefully we're trying to finalize the date here, and I'm sure we'll talk about this with him. But it seems like there's a lot of narrative out there that, well, as soon as we are able to legalize this and get it going, it's going to be such an economic jumpstart for the state. And honestly, Hugh, my concern, when I hear language like that, I cringe. Because I don't trust Trenton to manage a hot dog stand sometimes. You know, we heard 3 years no, hear me out. 3 years ago, the rhetoric, right, under Governor Christie and the Democratic control legislature was, well, the gas tax is vital because the gas tax is going to be put into a fund that's going to help transportation and infrastructure. Okay, well, that's the case. Now, apparently the auditor's report indicated that the gas tax did not raise as much money as anticipated, and therefore sometime in 2018 we'll see another rise in the gas tax, because eventually this fund will be not replenished, but it'll be filled sufficiently to ensure that infrastructure and other transportation issues are addressed in New Jersey. Well, you know what, Hugh, when I hear that and I hear that a gallon of gas is still pretty reasonable in New Jersey, it'd be a lot lower if it wasn't for the gas tax. You know, maybe if Trenton spent a little more responsibly, we wouldn't need the gas tax. I'm just concerned that when we hear this language of, oh, once it's legalized, man, can you imagine the revenue that we're going to raise in New Jersey? Because people from New York, I'm just really speculating, people from New York are going to cross the river and buy it because it's going to be cheaper. We're going to have so many dispensaries. You know, we're the most densely populated state in the country. Therefore, there are going to be dispensaries, you know, up the wazoo, blah, blah, blah. We hear all of this. And the first thing that comes to my mind is that Mitch Trenton starts getting their eyes all open and their mouth starts salivating because revenue is coming in. The first thing that comes to my mind is, uh-oh, they're going to find a way to waste this too. And that's a concern I think a lot of New Jerseyans have, Hugh. And I don't think I'm wrong here, man.
Right. Well, I mean, that's such as government. It's not a bad concern, right? I mean, the spending, government spending is quite often revenue can't keep up with spending. We don't do that in our own lives. I mean, most of us live on credit to some degree or another, or we, you know, we have mortgages, et cetera. That the fiscal responsibility is a different matter. And it's also very complex because at the same time, we all want, and we want our government and our legislatures to give, to basically give us things that we don't have to, you know, strive for on our own. or to make things right. And sometimes it's appropriate to do so, and sometimes it's just horrible rent seeking, and there's all this problems. And at the same time, that we turn around and say, "Wow, but now you're taking too much money," and we constantly live in this weird catch 22, and we do it in our own existences, right? Where we say, "Well, we want to live by our budget," and then we all pull out credit cards because we really want this short term fix, or we really want this outcome, or we really want to make this investment. And sometimes it makes sense, and sometimes we hurt for it. Now with cannabis, I think that I'm always leery of any of the particular arguments cast in too rosy a light. This will not be a cure for racial injustice. This will be a small but necessary step in the right direction. It's more something that's commanded by justice. It's not going to fix that. This is not going to fix our budgetary woes either. This will be something that will, and what I'm interested in is that it's a total economic effect. Yes, there will be tax revenue generated from that. And yes, the business itself will generate additional businesses that are there to service those businesses just like any other business, and that will continue to – there will be tax economic activity, brings more taxable revenue. Taxable revenue is a good thing. This will be taxed at a rate where in the state that's incredibly urgent with respect to growing growing an industry that is also – remember, we're putting everything – the standard for the cannabis industry is bizarrely high. We have to not only show it's fundamentally an innocuous substance, we have to also show that it is while innocuous, it's still a vice, yet it has medical benefits. We don't even have language to properly deal with it, but we have to show that it's almost like this perfect thing, that it has the industry itself will have this tremendous opportunity for racial redress, and that there will be just huge amounts of cash flowing in order to have, like, no other industry has to shoulder all of these burdens. And at some point, if we think that it's going to fix any one woe in total, or is going to inaugurate some new tremendously rosy day, we're mistaken. What we're going to end up with is first and foremost, right, is in my book, a celebration of freedom, right? Taking us back to the fact that this is not something that should have been deprived from adults. This is not the type of thing that requires the intervention of government to tell you whether or not you should or should be able to exercise your desires towards the substance. And meanwhile, we found all this great medical benefits as well. So it's even more high. I mean, that's first and foremost. But secondly, yes, this is a very good industry as a result. I mean, the beverage industry is a very good industry as well. It provides great deals of revenue. And this can provide tremendous amounts of revenue and has provided tremendous amounts of revenue. In Colorado, it's one of the largest revenue. I mean, this is a fact. These are real things. Now, what people do with the revenue and what our government does with the revenue and the type of things that our citizens demand our government does with the revenue and then complain about are all different matters. But the inauguration of a properly developed, intelligently designed, and fostered cannabis industry will have broad-based economic benefits. But let's also then say one other thing that we expect from the cannabis industry. We think the cannabis industry legalized will actually do what the – and here we're correct – will do what the policing and the prohibition of cannabis couldn't do, which is to eradicate – the abusive illicit market of cannabis and cannabis used in the service of even greater crimes and more widespread crimes. So we look to this regulated industry to also have an effect on reducing those types of social ills and the costs that go along with those as well. I mean, we should factor those in. It's very difficult to really project any numbers, but that should be of some benefit as well. So this industry and this legalization of cannabis is expected to do a whole lot. It's not to be harmful. It is also to be beneficial. It is to be redressive of injustices that were done because people were deprived. It's to provide the types of freedom that were envisioned in the founding of the state and this nation back to people. Oh, and at the same time, it's going to actually take more effectively police the illicit use of cannabis, especially when combined with other illicit substances. And criminality, it's going to effectively help police that. We put a pretty big standard on this plant. and those around it. But I think that the results have been encouraging all around. Have they been completely perfect in any one of these senses? No. Is it ridiculous to expect them to be? Yes. But will it become an area for each of us where there will be more to do? There'll be more to learn. Absolutely. But it's there, right? Each one of these things can be activated within this state when we take this step and we see the precedents. You've mentioned these precedents before. That's all correct. Within our broader, but once it does what it can do, I don't think it can actually enforce good fiscal behavior in our government. I think at that point the plant is exhausted once it does all these other things. But I hear you.
No, and again, I certainly feel it's a frustrating element here for many New Jerseyans as they're closely following these events and seeing, again, sort of the transition within the legislature. And we'll get back to sort of, you know, our frustrations with the legislature and sort of how far along this is within both chambers of the legislature in Trenton in terms of bills that already have been introduced and how far along they're moving. But I want to get to something with you, Hugh, tonight, because I think it's important for our audience. And what I try to do every week in not just informing our audience, but also educating our audience. And again, folks, if you're just joining us right now, it is 8:50 here on the East Coast. And with me tonight here on Politically Direct is the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association, Mr. Hugh O'Byrne. You can check out their organization at www.newjerseycia.org. You can follow them on Instagram and Twitter. Also, check them out on LinkedIn, and also make sure you like them on Facebook. Looking at the website, Hugh, and, you know, this is a topic that comes up a lot, and I'm sure that you have dealt with it repeatedly, whether it's been at workshops, whether it's been at symposiums, talking to members of the legislature, other nonprofit organizations throughout the state, even across the country perhaps. There seems to be, and I mentioned this, as a matter of fact, in one of my local government courses I teach at the local community college here, there seems still in 2019, Hugh, a fundamental generational disconnect that exists, I feel, with how cannabis and marijuana are perceived. And for as much literature as there is out there, as much science as there is out there, as much fact and logic as you can introduce into the conversation, there seems to be, again, and there's a lot of variables as to why perhaps people, you know, public opinion has swayed a lot where it's more favorable, but not, let's say, overwhelmingly. I argue, again, this is me being the scholar and academic, there's still a fundamental generational disconnect that exists when it comes to discussing marijuana and cannabis. And I don't know how much more work has to be put into this, but I think it's going to require a lot more than we're seeing. And we've seen a lot. You know, we've seen curriculum being introduced on our college campuses. We've seen, you know, not just your organization, but others in the state of New Jersey that have gone to Trenton, that have held town halls. And despite all of this awareness, Hugh, there seems still to be a disconnect between, you know, again, I think younger age demographics and those that, let's say, for example, are closer to retirement age or, what, I mean, again, I'm just trying to be as proper as possible when I'm trying to describe the age demographics. But I argue there's a fundamental generational disconnect that exists, and that's going to take a lot of work to erode. How do you see it, sir?
I think you're exactly right. I think you're exactly right. I do. I think that we're all but you're absolutely correct. There is. And there isn't many issues, and there has been over the years in many issues, and cannabis is certainly one that is going to have a great deal of concern by people that have lived in earlier, that have lived lives through earlier parts the latter half of the last century and seen some of the travails and some of the ways that cannabis was utilized as a boogeyman, and that we internalized these things and we were told these things and we developed certain rigidity where less we get busy with life, we fall into our past, we start to have concerns for not just the future, but the future of others, right? With children, so we get to be protective and we get worried. And it's always this difficult part when you, when your children, my children are getting going to college, and I'm starting to see them, and I know that they're drinking beers every so often. It's nerve-wracking because I remember what we all remember what we did, and then we think like, oh well, our well when we feel it in our own kids, it gets nervous. So these are all very, very understandable things, and it's quite a confluence. Now the thing that amazes me is that so much of the older demographics that we're worried about with respect to the aesthetic presumptions that I think they labor under, misconceptions about what cannabis really ever was or what it could ever really be, I think those are becoming a little bit more offset by the fact that there are many people in the older demographics that are actually appreciating cannabis's medical applications, its wellness applications. It does work really well for people as they're getting into the eras of the era of their life where aches and pains are more common, where mm-hmm. other you know, where you're bearing the scars of a life hard lived, right? For of hard work, et cetera. That we're seeing that people like this, like the plant because it has such little side effects compared to so many of the other things that they would normally be forced to. And it's also sometimes people just suffering from pill fatigue, right? That you just get older and you look around after a couple of years and you're like, well, how the hell did I? Why am I taking 5 pills a day? How did this happen, right? It just happens gradually, and then you're on them.
Actually,
like, oh, my God.
Actually, you know? You know what, Hugh? I'm sorry to cut you off. You know what? I'm glad you brought that up, and I just wanted to – and this was in my notes, and I wanted to make sure I brought this up to you today before I forgot. And I'm glad you just brought that up about pain medication because I was having this discussion with my colleague Monday, the day after the Super Bowl, and aside from the fact that a lot of the commercials weren't very good, maybe, like, let's say a handful of them were – I was outraged because I don't know if you saw it. I know it was reported in the New York Times. I saw it in USA Today. Now, the NFL, for example, makes the decision as to what commercials they choose to accept based on content and everything else. I mean, obviously, it's a flat fee. If you can afford the $2 million, let's say, for 30 seconds, the NFL will do that. What I found really disheartening, and I have a lot of reasons to hate Roger Goodell. I'm a Cowboys fan, so that in itself, I have a lot of reason to hate Roger Goodell. But, you know, the guy could not walk in front of a bus soon enough for me, but that's another story. But what I found really disheartening and hypocritical, Hugh, was the fact that there were two commercials. One was about more awareness about veterans' rights and, you know, creating opportunities for veterans. That disappointed me. But the second one that really bothered me, and not because I have a vested interest, because, you know, again, I don't utilize cannabis for anything. I don't smoke marijuana recreationally. It's not something that I really care about in the sense, like, it's not something I pursue. I understand the necessity of it. But I found it hypocritical that the NFL declined a medicinal marijuana commercial during the Super Bowl when it's the most violent sport on the planet. It is, you know, the lifespan of an NFL player is somewhere between 6 to 7 years tops. Okay, and the idea that you saw not one, not two, I counted, you saw 9 beer commercials, okay, during the Super Bowl. Now, I understand the NFL and beer are synonymous together. They've had a partnership for decades. But the idea that you don't want to – the idea you think it's okay to show 9 beer commercials, but and you don't approve a medicinal marijuana ad when it's been proven that for pain management – and for pain medication, it is an invaluable tool for players. It's preventing them from abusing prescription painkillers, which can translate into opioid abuse. And yet the NFL mm-hmm. still suspends people for 4 games due to their testing policy that if you test positive for marijuana, whatever the usage is, you're suspended for 4 games, so that's a quarter of your season, when most players have admitted to using it for pain management. And the fact that the NFL didn't approve that medicinal marijuana ad, but they insist on glorifying alcohol, I thought for me, Hugh, and I'm not trying to sound like I'm engaging in hyperbole, bro, I thought it was a disgrace. I thought it was preposterous. I thought it was egregious. And I thought it was ridiculous on the NFL's part that they would not even give any credence to science when it's known that medicinal marijuana and cannabis has been proven to relieve pain. And for a sport as violent as the NFL, Hugh, I thought for me, it's just another reflection of how out of touch and how stupid Roger Goodell is as the commissioner of the NFL. Okay, I'm sorry. That was my rant. I just want to get your thoughts on that. I'm sorry, but I just want to get your thoughts on that real quick.
My thoughts are I couldn't say it better. In fact, as I'm listening to it, I'm like, wow, I become so numb to the hypocrisy that hearing that is actually startling. I mean, you're spot on. That's exactly right. Like, it's madness. You're talking about medicinal marijuana. At a time when we're watching a sport that's violence causes all sorts of neurological issues and all sorts
it's
of
the most violent
those
sport,
to play
Hugh.
It.
Hugh, it's, Hugh it is
violent
the most violent sport
yeah.
on the planet. I mean, it's not even close.
Yeah.
You know, go on, I'm sorry.
Right. And then we glorify alcohol around it. And we know that alcohol has and I'm not saying get rid of alcohol by any means because it's an acceptable risk for the society. But alcohol as a substance, right, has more demonstrable negatives and not nearly the benefits that cannabis does, medicinal or otherwise. And yet we are all about that. I mean, imagine if we were just we're so afraid of cannabis, even when it's regulated, even if it's medicinal. Look at the weird celebration of alcohol, the colors, the vividness, the lack, the encouragement of just sort of the pizzazz around it. It's really if you imagine substitute cannabis in for any of those beer commercials, there would be riots would erupt. I mean, you're exactly right. The hypocrisy is what, and I don't think, you know, I wonder why has there been such a gestalt shift, right? Why has there been such a change in public attitudes since I got involved in advocacy for cannabis in the late 80s to now? And why did it happen? Startling how it happens kind of close. What were the inflection points? And I think it had to be around the point where the outrage of hypocrisy. No one likes to see hypocrisy. No one likes to be accused of being a hypocrite. No one likes to be engaged in it, and no one likes to excuse it. And I think at a certain point, once we sort of woke up and saw enough people had said enough times, this is not what it's been made out to be. And it was made out to be this other thing for very, very poor, very, very questionable, well, actually very, very bad reasons. And we've been treating it and patting ourselves on the back and pillaring it while we're, you know, engaging in something that's noticeably, many of these things have noticeably significantly more risks. Opioids, for instance, for chronic pain relief, it can often be a death sentence for people. Now, don't get me wrong, these are medicines. There are reasons why they exist, and they're appropriate in certain circumstances. But we're not ending up with the atrocious death rates from the abuse of this thing by mistake of opioids. And then alcohol, which if there's a gateway, any substance, I mean, alcohol is most likely it, but alcohol has all sorts of other negative effects around violence, judgment, that isn't found in cannabis. And we all kind of know that. We all kind of already knew that. But once it became more clear, then the hypocrisy of this illegalization and all that came with it really hit home. And I think that's what changed minds. I don't think it was quite so much that people said, wow, this is a wonder plant underneath it all. Or that, wow, why have we been curtailing freedom? Or, wow, we did this in large part to control minorities we were afraid of. And to disadvantage, to constrain them, right? It wasn't for any of those reasons, though any one of those would have been enough. The fact that we looked at it sort of in total and we said, wait a minute, guys, this is just hypocrisy. We do all these other things, but not this. And then that makes these other elements of the history of cannabis prohibition and the other elements of criminalization of cannabis all the more acute and all the more laughable if it wasn't so tragic. And that's what I think, like that outrage that you see, it's the hypocrisy. And once we got to that point, we start to see the hypocrisy in this everywhere. And that's what I think has really changed people's minds towards cannabis, is that the prohibition of cannabis is fundamentally hypocritical, right? When we do these other types of activities and why they're accepted. And it's even more hypocritical because it's often would be a better choice than these other substances that we celebrate lavishly.
Sure, yeah.
Right? So the hypocrisy
that hits us. Sure.
Right? It's visceral. It's visceral. And so then we say, no more. Like, just, my God, let's get over this. And I think that's where we're at. Yeah. But, yeah, you're right. There's nothing more to say. You're correct. 100%.
No, I mean, so demoralizing. And again, and I had this conversation with my colleague, and I said, you know, again, I'm a lifelong fan of the NFL. I watch it religiously. I like to read about stories, you know, success stories, and certainly it's heartbreaking when you hear about players later in life that have been, you know, really affected neurologically because of the hits to the head, and also their bodies have taken a toll. It just seems like a lot of them, you know, if these resources are available for these veterans, you know, these veteran players, and pain management can be, you know, sort of controlled by a doctor, and this can be monitored. Again, I see it as a win-win for a lot of people, not just athletes that are in dangerous sports, certainly other, you know, other individuals that are struggling with ailments. We see all the time how beneficial.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Military veterans, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's so many things. Why would this tool be hidden? Why would it be considered? Why is it not even allowed to be studied due to federal scheduling of the substance? Why can't clinical research happen? If nothing else, why won't they let the Mayo Clinic and Harvard University and Princeton, Rutgers, and our fine institutions all around, why can't they actually do clinical research around the substance? Why is it proclosed?
Oh, absolutely.
That's a part of it. It wasn't just
absolutely.
We knew that the substance did nothing, it was bad for you, so bad that you were not allowed to have it, or we will come and take your liberty and property from you for having it. Not only did we know that, we know that there was no way we could be wrong because we were so sure of it. We said, we may not even study it. We can't even study it. We're not even going to allow our research, our clinical ecosystem to engage, and our academic world to engage with the study of cannabis, because we know it's so bad and we know there's nothing more to learn. We don't do the, thank God we don't do that with many things. What we say, we in 1971, we knew everything there was to ever know about this substance definitively, so that we were not even going to allow it to be studied further. That's weird.
No, it really is. It really is. And I think also, you know, Hugh, what's demoralizing about this situation is, again, we're seeing that science is proving how beneficial it's being to veterans, who are dealing with PTSD and other ailments. We know individuals that are struggling with the after effects of chemotherapy. You know, I'm someone that has volunteered a lot of his time over the years to the American Cancer Society. I've talked to cancer patients. I know people personally that have dealt with cancer.
Yeah.
We know the medical benefits of what cannabis has done to people recovering from chemotherapy, to recover their appetites because they have to eat, they have to be healthy. The idea of people suffering from other neurological disorders, such as epilepsy, cerebral palsy,
ALS.
And I mean, those are in ALS.
Go to a
medical
dispensary, right? And you'll be
really
shocked. It's often a hard place to be because you see a lot of very sick people looking for some relief from often terminal conditions. It is not deadhead Rasta time and drum circles. This is a place where you find where you're around a lot of sick people and a lot of suffering people, and it's a lot harder than you think it is if you haven't been in the medical dispensaries to actually be there and see what's going on and who these clients are. You know, absolutely. One thing I'd love to note is it's demoralizing that we are here in the one sense that we've gotten to this point. But it's also really encouraging, I think you have to admit, that now we do know this, that despite all of the demoralizing apparatus that was put in place for so long, enough light has shined through that we now see what we see and we know there is more to do. So I'm actually encouraged we are where we are. This is a much different world than it was in 1990. And we've learned a lot more, and a lot more people are now able to have some relief from the stresses of illness and the stresses of things like PTSD and other neurological syndromes that they may have, autoimmune syndromes, et cetera. This is a new and wonderful thing. So I'm actually encouraged by this. I'm encouraged by it, and I'm sobered by it because
that it's something that has to be fostered and developed. And we need to learn more about it, and we have to try and engage it and understand it. We need to protect our medical, even in the, you know, legalization.
Sure.
It is a great thing, but it can tend to erode a medical program. So unless there are proper steps taken to encourage the continued engagement of physicians and patients in that program, and if there was a state, there's no state with more of a need to make sure and more to benefit from having a robust medical program in cannabis than New Jersey, because
sure.
we have such a wonderful clinical ecosystem otherwise for pharma. We really have a tremendous clinical ecosystem. We have an academic apparatus around pharmacology that's so amazing that there will be a handoff. There'll be something that a medical cannabis program will be able to do. But then the knowledge that the medical cannabis programs around the states and around other nations are putting together is allowing, finally trickling into our clinical world, though they still can't really do clinical trials, to the point where they're finding more applications for even more acute, right? So more pharmacological applications around the endocannabinoid regulatory system and around cannabis in our brains to deal with more acute things than simply phytocannabinoids. Right? So there's a point where there will be an upward the developments in our medical program will actually have feed into our larger clinical ecosystem, our larger academic ecosystem as a state that has a lot of benefits, economic included.
Now, Hugh, one of the things that comes up a lot in conversation, and we know that as a lot of the, not the hysteria, but maybe a lot of the myths that we read about when it comes to cannabis and marijuana, they've been debunked over the years. And clearly, you know, your organization, folks, again, if you're just joining us right now, it is 9/11 on the East Coast here on Blue Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have you on Politically Direct. The president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association, Mr. Hugh O'Byrne, joins us still here on the show. You can check out their organization at www.newjerseycia.org. And folks, again, if you can, do me a favor. There's a green button right on their website. It says donate. And I know that sometimes when we are commuting to work and we oftentimes, you know, go get that coffee or go get that muffin or go get that croissant, do me a favor. Instead of doing it 5 days a week when you go to work, do it 3 days a week. And the other 2 days, save that money up. And you know what? At the end of the month, take that amount of change that you're accumulating, go to the website, click on donate, and donate that to them. They're doing good work. And if it's two less, you know, caramel macchiatos that you're having with a granola bar, hey, believe me, it's going for a good cause. So do that at the website, www.newjerseyca.org. Click the donate button. Trust me, I approve it. And, they're doing good work. So, Hugh, I hope you like that little shameless plug there tonight here. I wanted to make sure I got
It was really very, very charitable and very, very kind.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
No,
listen, I'm glad to support you. But one of the things I wanted to sort of ask you, because I think it comes up a lot in conversation, is, you know, even despite with science and proving what the medicinal benefits are, There still seems to be sort of a fundamental concern, not just in New Jersey, but I think even nationally, when it comes to the issue of impaired driving. And we know that impaired driving when it comes to alcohol is dealt with very seriously across all 50 states. We know New Jersey, for example, has the most severe and the most strict penalties when it comes to DWIs in New Jersey when it comes to alcohol. Now, again, the technology is not there to monitor impaired driving, let's say when it comes to cannabis, the same way, you know, there's no blood alcohol level device that's calibrated, right, that police departments use or can use to detect this. But how real of a concern is it when you hear detractors say, well, we're worried that once we legalize cannabis, excuse me, marijuana, that people are just going to maybe drive high, and very much the same concerns people have about people driving drunk under alcohol. People are going to be driving high. That could pose a serious risk to motorists in New Jersey. We're already the most densely populated state in the country. We have sometimes 10 times the amount of motorists that five other states have combined. And a lot of law enforcement agencies, a lot of nonprofits are saying, hey, we got to slow down here, because once we start kind of not normalizing, but we start seeing more and more people driving impaired, there isn't a way to monitor this or even sanction it. And a lot of parents will talk about this openly on social media, at town halls. How do you answer those detractors when these concerns come up about, let's say, impaired driving?
Yeah, I mean, let's step back. I mean, the concerns with cannabis, I think that when we say innocuous, and yes, there's medical benefits, when we say innocuous, what we're fundamentally saying is that it's not risk-free, but that the risks are assumable and significantly outweigh the needs. The risks are not the risks are assumable in the sense that they're not significant enough to validate the continued prohibition of things. And we don't have like multiple choices. We're either prohibiting something with police, or we're not prohibiting something with police. We look at some of the risks associated with marijuana and cannabis. I think we should just be clear about a few of them. One is that this is a substance like all that needs to be dealt with in moderation and intelligently. No one should be encouraged to go into excess with anything, and this is one of those things. I just make that as a general statement. Two, there are probably people that shouldn't smoke cannabis, right? People that are prone to psychotic episodes. Like, think about it, right? Those people shouldn't drink either, right? There are people that have certain types of medical conditions that they should be very careful about how they go about engaging with substances. Effects outside of doctor supervision because they really need it because something's up with them. All right, so there's that. Three, children, it's just not, no, just don't. No, we can't. We have to draw the line somewhere. Children don't have the adulthood and don't have enough maturity to really engage this. And we all agree on that, and I think it's an important thing. Children, don't do this. Not now. There will be a time to do it. Don't start doing it when you're young, and don't do it heavily because there is some question about cannabis's heavy cannabis use in adolescents having some permanent neurological effects. By the way, same thing with alcohol, heavy alcohol. I mean, we don't want to see those types of things happen. No one in the pro-legalization side is saying, go for it, kids. In fact, we're saying that legalization will actually have some benefits with respect to being able to better regulate people's access to cannabis because we'll be removing, out-competing more sort of nefarious and unregulated elements of the black market. Okay, there's that. And then there's this next one. This is a real concern. Driving high is not a good idea. It's also not without risks. The risks are overstated because cannabis intoxication is not all the same. Intoxication, drugs is a very generic term and also a legal term, but it's pharmacologically not identical, right? So the effects of intoxication on opioids or benzodiazepine or the effects of those whatever intoxicants have on your judgment and your motor skills are different. Alcohol, your motor skills and judgment are affected at a much higher rate than certainly cannabis or benzodiazepines and potentially even opioids, right, depending on how much you're taking. The intoxications have different effects. The concerns about cannabis and the data about cannabis leading to all sorts of chaos on the roads is often graphically misstated by improperly looking at some of the studies that have come out of Colorado and notably Washington State. With that said, it's not a nothing. It's not a good idea. It's not a nothing. We didn't wait for breathalyzers to come along before we allowed alcohol to be legal. Seeing an impaired driver is the first. We don't give people typically breathalyzers for nothing. We see that there's something wrong with their driving, and we assess. The breathalyzer is a tool, right? It is a tool that happens after someone has been noted to be driving, exhibiting signs of impairment. If you're exhibiting signs of impairment, then we have to assess whether there's impairment. There is a way of doing that, and it does work. It isn't as ideal as having a breathalyzer. It's through drug recognition experts and training. It's actually very effective, and it's how we tended to do things through good policing and training before we had technologies to fill those gaps. Those are things that are just going to have to be put in place to deal with the situation. But the data doesn't show anywhere that there's this massive increase whatsoever. But I always feel weird saying this because I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying that it's not a thing. You know, it's not something we should have some concern about. It is. And responsibility is in the hands of all adults. If you are going to have the freedom and the autonomy to make decisions for yourself, you have to be able to do that in a way that does not threaten the well-being of others, right? And that's a really, really important thing.
Now, the good news, besides the fact that this is not the effects of cannabis are not commensurate with those of alcohol, and the amount and as a result the amount of accidents and fatalities, though the data can often be messed up, doesn't actually show tremendous significant increases of any sort in some of these other states with respect to cannabis alone. That's all good news. And I think it means that we have, in this instance as well, we haven't identified an area of cannabis that says, wow, the risks are such in this area that it means we have to take it away altogether and go back to policing it. And even though we know that's ineffective for black market activity and people, there's lots of cannabis around right now and people are engaging in, you know, driving on it. Generally, when cannabis gets legal, there isn't an explosion of new cannabis users. It's more of a shift of black market users into regulated users. So I'm not thinking we'd see any kind of major spikes, and that's maybe why we haven't seen major spikes that everyone thought they would in the West. But even all of that, the quest for a useful assessment tool is bearing some really good fruit, and it's getting there. I don't think we have pointed out a risk that says that policing – prohibiting cannabis through policing is worth it at all. I don't want to diminish the fact that that this is something like you shouldn't smoke cannabis or ingest cannabis and fly a plane. You shouldn't drive a car if you're impaired under any circumstances. That goes for benzodiazepines like Xanax and things like that as well, which we often forget. But there are labels on a lot of drugs that say do not operate heavy equipment, and everyone does.
Yes,
we got to be really cognizant of those things. But there are the mouth swabs. There are some that are getting approved by the FDA. They're in trials. They're proving the science is showing that blood tests, unlike alcohol, the half life of cannabis and the half life of alcohol are different. So as a result, it doesn't really tell you anything when you see the blood test of alcohol. But a mouth swab of alcohol, cannabis's interaction with saliva does approximate a good half-life. So maybe there's it appears that there's a mouth swab technique. Now, that'll be great, right? You get to the point, you see an impaired driver. Now you have two tools. Breathalyzer, okay, you pass the breathalyzer. Mouth swab, okay, your impairment is due to cannabis. Or you do both of those, and it's not – If someone's driving erratically and they blow under intoxication on a breathalyzer, they still don't just say, oh, go about your way. They bring our drug recognition expert, and you may still have to do that because there are plenty of other ways to be intoxicated while you're driving other than cannabis and alcohol, and that's why this will
sure.
always be a feature. But, yeah, this is where we're needing to go, and we're seeing it, right? We're seeing it. This will happen.
Well, again, and, you know, Hugh, it's one of those topics that generates a lot of debate and certainly a lot of conversation in New Jersey. And, you know, I could have you on tonight for 3 hours and not get through everything. And again, you know, you have been an invaluable host tonight. And I hope that our audience has really enjoyed the dialogue because, you know, you've been educational this evening. For our audience maybe joining us for the first time and learning about what your organization stands for and the good work that you do, you know, before I let you go, again, number one, I want to thank you for your time. It's been absolutely incredible to have you on here tonight. It's been, again, extremely illuminating to have you join me on the program and to really talk about this issue because it's a topic that is gaining momentum. It's been gaining momentum for years in New Jersey. As we said at the onset of the program, let's find out in 2019 what the legislature is going to be doing about not just decriminalization, certainly expungement is an important component, the variables associated with outright legalization. And I know that, you know, you and, you know, the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association are at the forefront of it. So, again, I want to thank you in advance for donating your time tonight. I hope you've enjoyed the experience once again. I think we've had a wonderful conversation that our audience, I'm hoping, has enjoyed and has appreciated. And before I let you go, what I'd like to do to all my guests is, you know, we've had a conversation. I think it's been very fruitful, but I've been the one asking the questions. I've been the one, not necessarily putting you in the hot seat, but I've been interviewing you. What I do now is I give my guests the floor to either grill me about something or take me to task or just pick my brain. So now's your time, Hugh, to, you know, ask away or, you know, anything you got for me. I'm all ears, brother.
Well, I mean, I'm interested in thinking in getting to know how I'm so close to the issue that I see it all the time. And I would love, remembering now our last year, our conversation and some of the concerns we talked a lot more about, like just decriminalization and just legalization. I'm just wondering, from being a really astute, dialed in observer to things going on in the state socially and politically, how have you, what's your assessment of how everything's been unfolding? And I don't mean on the political scale. I mean the assessment of the dialogue, generally speaking, about legalization, about this industry. There's more questions and interest than there is and interest in the thing than there is available answers at the moment. But I'm just really curious to get your take on what have you sort of witnessed and felt and heard, and what's your thoughts?
Well, I'll say this. I mean, since our conversation last year on the show, I mean, both here on Politically Direct via Insider NJ and also on my local podcast that I do in Hudson County, I've had state senators on. I've had state senators that have been very vocal in terms of their opposition, such as State Senator Ronald Rice. He's been on the show last year. We had almost a two-hour episode, commercial-free, where myself and Senator Rice really had a pretty meaningful dialogue to really get to the heart of the matter about, you know, how he feels about it. I also had State Senator Weinberg on. I've had State Senator Brian Stack, who I'm sure you're familiar with up here in Hudson County, as well as State Senators Cunningham and Sacco, respectively. And I've had different assemblymen and women throughout the state and different organizations. And, you know, to me, again, I think I've remained consistent in really urging them to act on this, to do their due diligence, to make sure that we examine expungements and do this correctly. You know, we have tens upon thousands of people still incarcerated in New Jersey. We have tens upon thousands of people on probation or pretrial intervention, for example, or parole that are still experiencing the after effects of these antiquated drug laws. And I've been consistent on this show, on both podcasts, in saying that I'm hoping that the legislature really works on this expediently, because it's such an important component, Hugh. I mean, I tell my students all the time, and again, these are all college-age students, I said, you know, right now in New Jersey, if you're caught with marijuana, I mean, it could be absolutely destructive for your life. I mean, you know, you're going to lose your financial aid, which subsequently means most likely you're going to have to, you know, unenroll from the college you're attending. You're going to have a criminal offense on your abstract. You're going to be most likely, you know, you'll plead guilty. You might not get jail time, but you'll be sent to probation. You'll be assessed and just an exorbitant amount of fines. And guess what, Hugh? You can't pay those fines because you're not working. And why aren't you working? Because you can't get a job because of a criminal record. And it becomes an awful cycle. And it becomes an awful cycle. And I've told legislators on this show, I said, listen, I'm not someone that uses it recreationally at all for anything. That's not me. Again, that doesn't make me better than anybody. I just choose not to engage in it. But I have read – listen, I'm a bookworm. I have read countless amounts of literature. I've talked about it in my courses, and I have talked about it on shows. I mean, I've appeared on NJTV, for God's sakes, to talk about this, and I'm plus on my own podcast, and I've been consistent. I haven't wavered from the fact that this needs to be addressed. And again, you know, if there's a concern about the outright legalization, fine. You know, there's the fear of, well, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle once it happens. But decriminalizing cannabis and marijuana, the urgency of addressing expungements, the urgency of legitimate criminal justice reform needs to happen ASAP. And I'm going to continue being a crusader about it on this program. I'm going to continue being an advocate. And again, the consensus for me, he was every guest I've had has said, you know what, Fernando, I have yet to hear a guest. You know, even Ronald Rice, the most staunch of opponents about outright legal. Again, Senator Rice is adamant about decriminalization. I know him and State Senator Cunningham here in Hudson County introduced the bill concurrently last year, which I know is still making its way in the pipeline. But even I know that when I had State Senator Rice on, I was maybe not able to change his mind, but we had a dialogue. And that's what we need, Hugh, a conversation where we can be productive. And the more we do that, bro, the more we engage in productive dialogue, the sooner we come up with solutions. That's my two cents about it, brother.
And you know, Fernando, what I prize about your shows so much is that, you know, we're in this age of like polarizing sound bites, where they'll most often I'm asked for a quote and like keep it into a sentence or shorter. This is what happens with your show, this dialogue. There's complexities. Not everything's team sports. So it's not all us versus them. There are nuances, and these things have to be teased out. They have to be talked through. They need to take time. And there's so few places. This is what I love about the work that you do, because it is a forum for actual civic dialogue to take place that gives it some of the time that it needs to really mull over all of the various complexities and moving parts. And cannabis, of course, is massively so. And I really, really appreciate that, because it's one of the really, truly few venues where we're away from the sound bites and we're really talking and addressing some of the deeper concerns and really trying to elucidate these nuances. And everyone says God's in the details, but no one wants to pay attention to details. They just want to look at, you know, these flyover big picture. Oh, I got it. Yep. Yes. No. Up. Down. Right. And then they'll say, "Oh, but God's in the deep." But that takes time and effort. So I love what you've done about that. I do believe that we're knocking on the door of this, and I think the next time we talk, which hopefully won't be a year from now, we'll be talking how has it worked out so far. And I think that's what the dialogue will be, and we'll be able to take the first steps of an assessment of implementation of this new reality, because we will have crossed, and I believe we are imminently going to cross this threshold, and two things will occur. One, we'll see a tremendous vista of opportunities, and two, we'll say, huh, that was it? What was all the hubbub?
You know,
right?
Exactly.
And I think that's
exactly
what we'll see.
Exactly. And again, as 2019 progresses, I certainly will keep in touch with you, and if we see any sort of breaking developments, or we see a real acceleration in terms of the bills advancing in Trenton on the floor of the legislature. Listen, I'll more than happy to get you back on, and we'll be able to, you know, catch up and really engage the audience. So again, Hugh, I want to thank you again for joining us. And folks, again, tonight here, I do want to thank, as I mentioned, Mr. Hugh O'Byrne, the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association. Check out their website, folks. It's www.newjerseycia.org. Once you go on the website, it's just a plethora of resources there. You can find out everything about their mission statement, their vision, if you're looking to volunteer with this nonprofit organization. But more importantly, folks, you know, they don't operate on oxygen. I mean, they certainly need your support. and listen, if you can click on the green button on their website, as I mentioned before, for all of us that commute to work, whatever we're doing, whether we're taking New Jersey Transit and how late those trains are, or we're stuck in tunnel traffic, whatever the case may be, whether we're getting coffee, a muffin, donuts, whatever, do me a favor. If you're doing it 5 days a week, just buy something 3 days. And the other 2 days, add those numbers up. At the end of the month, click on the donate button. It's you know, it's safe and secure on there. It's also tax deductible. Help them out. They're a great nonprofit here in New Jersey, and they're doing good work for the people and for the advocacy of not just the cannabis community, but I think for a good overall public health initiative that they're champions for. So check them out, www.newjerseycia.org. Donate online. Make sure you follow them on Instagram and Twitter. Also, check them out on LinkedIn, and also like them on Facebook. Hugh, it's a pleasure, brother. We will certainly be in touch. And do me a favor, tell everybody you know how much you love Politically Direct, and ask them to follow the show and like it as well, sir. Okay?
Fernando, it is an honor and pleasure as usual. I look forward to the next time, and will do.
All right, brother. Listen, be well,
all right.
And we'll talk to you. We'll hopefully talk to you later this spring.
All right. All the best. Take care.
All right. You too. Have a good night, bro. All right, folks, here, 9:33 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. And an excellent episode here tonight on Politically Direct. Again, just a wealth of information, folks, with Mr. Hugh O'Byrne, the president, again, of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association. So, folks, I can't say enough really about how important a topic this is. And we've talked about it repeatedly, not just with his organization. We've had other advocates on here. We've had legislators who have been very transparent in talking about the advancements when it comes to legislation as it pertains to decriminalizing marijuana and cannabis, to talking about the recreational aspect of marijuana, how whether or not it will be legalized in 2019. We know, listen, it was one of Governor Murphy, then it was candidate Phil Murphy's top five things on his agenda, and we know it's a very progressive agenda that Phil Murphy pursued. Upon taking office, I know that he was adamant about getting this passed. We know that it took almost a full calendar year for the minimum wage to be raised, even in the small increments that we've seen. So we know that the legislature and him, who have been at odds for multiple reasons, whether it's politics or petty partisanship, the bottom line is that it took a full year even for the minimum wage to increase. And you know, for a lot of advocates in New Jersey, folks, the idea of waiting another calendar year for this to pass might be too much of a burden to bear for a lot of New Jerseyans. So I'm hoping that if you're hearing me out here, Governor Murphy, I know that I've been in touch with your office. Certainly we're trying to, you know, pin down a date where the governor will be able to call in and be a guest. I'm very much looking forward to that. The governor is always welcome here on this show, as well as anybody else from Trenton, certainly any legislature, legislator, to come on here and talk about this issue, because it really affects thousands of New Jerseyans every day. So we're happy to talk about it here on the air. We'll continue being an advocate for it and certainly bringing you the latest news in terms of how this is progressing on the floor of the legislature in Trenton in both chambers. So again, we'll definitely let you know any progress in the weeks and months ahead. And we'll see how it unravels here in 2019. Now, folks, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, you can always go and we'll have the episode in its entirety with Hugh O'Byrne, the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association. Again, Hugh O'Byrne, a wonderful guest tonight. You can check it out by going to www.insidernj.com/podcast. We'll have the episode in its entirety at the top of the hour. And, of course, you can download it from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. If you have a topic or issue you want to hear about in the coming weeks, folks, if you have any opinions about tonight's guest and what we discussed, I'd love to hear from you. Write to me, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, @politicallydirectnj. Don't forget to follow me directly on Instagram, @your_favorite_Fernando. Of course, check me out on Twitter. I'm always posting some very interesting links and opinions every day on Twitter, @ProfessorFuribe. Don't forget to like Politically Direct on Facebook. Brand new likes, brand new shares, brand new follows every single day. Again, folks, without you, my loyal listening audience, this wouldn't be possible. So I really do appreciate all the love on all of my social media platforms concerning Politically Direct. And don't forget to check out Insider NJ, folks, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene and also the best journalism that you'll find anywhere in state of New Jersey. It's always brought to you by Insider NJ. Again, don't forget to follow them on Twitter and check them out on Facebook and like them. Again, www.insidernj.com. Once you click on the homepage, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on that. You'll be automatically subscribed as it pertains to the morning intelligence briefing, which you'll get delivered conveniently to your inbox. So in the mornings when you're watching, let's say, your sports talk shows like I like to when I'm getting dressed for work, whether it's ESPN or Fox Sports, or you're watching the cable news circuits, whether it's CNN, New Day, Fox and Friends on the Fox News channel, whether it's Morning Joe on MSNBC or any of the other morning shows, hey, do me a favor. As you're scrolling through your smartphone or your Mac, your tablet, hey, the morning intelligence briefing will be right there in your email every single morning. So check it out. And folks, don't forget to check out the best news every day with Insider NJ. All right, folks, again, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. A wonderful episode. And, you know, never forget that whether it's on your morning commute, getting a daily workout in, walking your dog, hopefully as the days are getting warmer here, you're doing laundry, maybe for some that are doing homework or doing catching up on their reading, take a break, tune in, and trust me, you'll be happy that you did. It's real. It's here. It is Politically Direct. Good night. Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Got some new fans reaching out here on the Facebook page out of Lawrenceville, right outside of Trenton. Appreciate the love down there in Central Jersey. Hope you're enjoying the show. And again, tell all your friends about the absolute best commentary that you'll ever hear every single week, live, every Thursday night, right here on Blog Talk Radio, look no further, folks. It's always politically direct. Again, please party responsibly and enjoy your weekend, ladies and gentlemen. And I'll see you next week here, folks, on Blog Talk Radio, which I'll have a very special guest. I'll have New Jersey Republican Party Chairman, Mr. Doug Steinhardt, on the show. A lot to talk about with the upcoming Republican Leadership Conference in Atlantic City at the first weekend of March. It'll be great to have the state chairman of the Republican Party, again, Mr. Doug Steinhardt, exclusively here next week on Politically Direct. Folks, have a wonderful weekend. God bless. Take care of yourselves. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.